The Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia. Oyez, oyez, oyez. Silence is commanded on pain of imprisonment while the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia are sitting. All persons having business with this court will draw near and give their attention. Any having pleas to enter or suits to prosecute, let them come forward and they shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth and this Honorable Court.
The clerk will call the first case.
International Paper Company versus County of Isle of Wight, Craig D. Bell, E. Duncan Getchell, Robert W. Lofton, Michael H. Brady, Appellant's Counsel, Andrew R. McRoberts, Deborah L. Mallory, David C. Tate, Sean M. Hudson, Mark C. Popovic, Robert W. Jones, Jr., Appellee's Counsel. Mr. Bell, are you connected and can you hear me?
I am connected and I can hear you.
Thank you. Mr. McRoberts, are you connected and can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Chief Justice Lemons, can you hear both counsel? Chief Justice Lemons? I'll proceed through the roll and return to Chief Justice. Justice Goodwin, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Thank you. Justice Mims, can you hear both counsel?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Justice Powell, can you hear both counsel?
Yes, I can.
Justice Kelsey, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Chasen, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Thank you. Chief Justice Lemons, can you hear both counsel?
Try them again.
Mr. Bell, can you confirm your connection?
Mr. Bell speaking, I can confirm the connection.
Mr. McRoberts, can you confirm yours?
Yes, I can. I can hear you just fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I can hear them both.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, the parties are ready to proceed.
All right. Mr. Bell, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Craig Bell. I'm from McGuire Woods and I'm appearing on behalf of International Paper Company. I request to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
IP has assigned 4 errors to the circuit court decision. IP is entitled to prevail on all 4 assignments of error. We believe the court can resolve this appeal and grant final judgment. Even if this appeal arose in a different procedural posture and not from a motion striking taxpayers' case, the material facts would remain undisputed. IP's 4 assignments of error may be grouped into 2 buckets. The first bucket contains IP's challenge to non-uniform taxation of its M&T. The second bucket contains IP's challenges to the county clawing back its M&T tax refund to the penny by violating IP's vested rights, separation of powers, and exceeding the locality's taxing authority. IP has fully briefed the issues in these 2 buckets, and we will rest on our briefs as to the second bucket. My argument today, I would like to focus on the first bucket, non-uniformity, and then talk about the remedy IP seeks from this court. And to get started on the non-uniformity argument, I would direct the court's attention to our opening brief. Attached at the end is a 1-page exhibit from the trial. It is a scatter plot document, exhibit 70. It also appears in the joint appendix at page 1263. The uniformity violation is plain. The Virginia Constitution requires that direct taxes be uniform upon the same class of subjects within the territorial limits of the authority levying the tax. But the M&T taxes assessed against IP were anything but uniform. This 1-page exhibit demonstrates this point. If the M&T taxes were uniform, there would not be a scatter plot, but instead there would be 100 green dots all aligned horizontally at the $4.24 rate at the top of the scatter plot. This blatant uniformity violation invalidates the 2017 assessment. The purpose of the uniformity requirement is that those property owners who are similarly situated in the same class of property must be treated in a like manner by the law. The uniformity requirement ensures that the burden of taxation is distributed evenly and equitably among the members of the class. Localities cannot impose ad valorem property taxes, which includes M&T, in a manner that unequally burdens the same class of property. And again, I would direct your attention to this exhibit attached to our brief, the scatter plot. What Isle-White County did through its M&T tax strategy is levy a wide varying tax burden among members of the M&T property class. So if you look at this exhibit and you look at the green dots, that's $4.24 per hundred. That is the rate that was adopted by the Board of Supervisors for the 22 tax assessment in its clawback ordinance. If you look at the bottom of that chart, the yellow dots, that is the $1.75 rate per hundred that was used by the county in deriving its tax strategy to generate tax credits or subtractions or partial exemptions that were applied to certain taxpayers and not to other taxpayers. The red dots between the green and the yellow are varying tax rates. It's important to note that each dot, and there's 100 dots, represents a separate taxpayer who filed and paid taxes to Isle-White County for 2017. If the county's actions were uniform, again, you would only see a straight horizontal 100-dot green line along the top. Instead, this chart depicts 35 different tax burdens caused by the county providing certain taxpayers within the M&T class a tax credit or deduction or partial exemption. And the reason I'm using those words tax credit, deduction, or partial exemption is because that are some of the wording used by witnesses at the trial, despite what the county has maintained in its briefs. The county engaged in a single legislative program, which has to be judged by its effect, as this is an as-applied constitutional challenge to the 2017 M&T tax assessment levied against IP. At the joint appendix at page 1100, and also at page 1107 are the whereas classes which set up the clawback ordinance and the clawback credit as part of a uniform legislative action to enable differing tax burdens to be extracted from the M&T taxpayers. Primarily, the burdens are changed in that it focused on any taxpayer who received a refund to enable the county to take back that refund from that taxpayer, but not to other taxpayers who didn't get a refund. IP's 2017 tax assessment is the result of the two legislative acts. It's formulated by one county official, proposed to the County Board of Supervisors at one time, adopted with express reference to each other. The clawback ordinance and the clawback credit were both only and ever to be implemented via the single act of assessing M&T in 2017. The purpose and effect of the two legislative acts must be judged as part of the same M&T tax strategy and not in isolation from each other. Once a property tax class has been established, that class may not be taxed in two or more ways. Here, the county set out the M&T taxpayers in essentially three classes, as identified in this scatterplot diagram by three separate colors. The 100 bills that were sent to the M&T taxpayers also had cover letters that were color-coded that match the dots on this chart. Those that were assessed the full rate at $4.24 per hundred, those that ended up with a $1.75 rate after receiving a deduction for new business, and then those in between who got varying amounts depending on the amount of refund they got. Any act that has the effect of allowing one taxpayer to pay less than another taxpayer similarly situated is required to pay offends uniformity whether the different treatment is affected by credits, full or partial exemptions, contracts, or other devices. This court addressed those types of issues in its 1929 decision of City of Bristol versus Dominion National Bank, and even earlier in 1903 in Davy Roberts involving the same Isle of Wight County. I'd like to talk about the remedy that IP seeks today. We are requesting that the court set aside IP's 2017 assessment as erroneous and to refund all monies collected from IP in this assessment.
Mr. Bell, this is Jeff Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a question briefly.
Yes, sir.
Can you give me, from your perspective, the best and narrowest construction of Article 10 of the Virginia Constitution and the uniformity provision that gets to where you want to go? How would you interpret that provision in its narrowest form and you still win your case? Because what you've given us is a lot of very broad principles. I'm looking for the limiting principle.
The limiting principle should be that the tax assessed against the taxpayer in the M&T class should be the stated rate that is enacted by the Board of Supervisors for that year multiplied by the assessed value that the property reported by that M&T taxpayer. That's it. And in this case, of course, the county engaged in a third act to vary the amount of that tax bill, which led to unequal tax burdens. So again,
well, that's a pretty strict uniformity that you're requiring in the way that you articulate the standard. Is that broad expression really necessary? Is that the best way to interpret the uniformity provision?
I think you could state that any other action outside of a tax rate lawfully enacted by the governing locality times the assessed value properly set by the assessing officer of the locality are the two elements that lead to an M&T tax assessment, and that any other act or action that impacts the tax burden of that taxpayer should be set aside as illegal and not given any force or effect. In this case, because the clawback ordinance and credit were enacted as a tax scheme, a unified plan, it actually goes to undermine the tax assessment in its full, the entire assessment, because there is no levy on the M&T that is free of the unconstitutional taint caused by the clawback ordinance. This case is not like the Perkins v. Albemarle County 1973 decision of the court, which the county argues dispenses with this case, where the unconstitutional part of the assessment was not validly levied, but only the assessor's approach to determining property values was improper. Nor is it possible, consistent with the board's intent, to sever the M&T into the constitutional and unconstitutional portions. In this case, Isle of Wight levied one rate on M&T tax in the clawback ordinance, which was selected to deprive M&T taxpayers of the refunds and was adopted in express reliance on the applicability of the clawback credit. Isle of Wight adopted the credit expressly because it had imposed the clawback rate. These two legislative acts are one, applicable through an assessment, and together operate to violate the Virginia Constitution. As this court said in 1942, holding where an ordinance levying a tax is unconstitutional, it is not law, it conveys no rights, it imposes no duties, it affords no protections, it creates no office, it is, in legal contemplation, as inoperative as though it had never been passed, and there is no ordinance in force. All sums collected under the ordinance are sums illegally collected and held by the city. That is the
Mr. Bell, this is,
for Hughes Banks.
Mr. Bell, this is Justice Goodwin. If you were to prevail and the court were to find the credit and the tax increase to have been invalid, wouldn't that make the tax rate that was passed by the county in 2016 of $1.75 per hundred the tax rate that would be applicable in 2017?
No, because of the jointness of the rate and the credit being adopted together, that tax rate at $1.75 of the prior year, this court would now be getting into the tax rate setting business, which both parties.
What I'm saying is, if you void the increase, then the tax rate would be what it was before the increase took place.
That would be for that year, and that would mean IP is treated separately than the other taxpayers within that class who are paying something other than $1.75, and so there's still a lack of uniformity with respect to the other members in the class.
I guess I don't understand your answer, because the premise of my question was that one would find that the increased tax rate of 424 was invalid, as was the credit, and then you would go back to the tax rate as passed by the county in previous years, wouldn't you?
The $1.75 tax rate was levied only for fiscal year 2016-2017, and it was not in force in 2017-2018. The county's fiscal year is a 1 July through 30 June, so the 2017 tax year began on July 1, 2017. So the prior year ordinance was no longer in effect and had been superseded.
Mr. Bell, you have 5 minutes and 38 seconds left. You may use your time any way you would like.
I would request to reserve that for rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. McRoberts?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
All right, thank you. May it please the court. My name is Andrew McRoberts, here on behalf of Isle of Wight County. This case is a constitutional challenge to legislative acts of the governing body of Isle of Wight, and so a proper review of it starts with the presumption of constitutionality. And as the trial judge properly said, even viewing evidence in a light most favorable to International Paper, who I may call IP from time to time, still doesn't get you very far given the evidence in the case and the constitutionality, because this court has directed courts to look narrowly at constitutional issues, to avoid them when possible, and when it's not possible to avoid them, to decide them in favor of the local legislative body if there is any way to view the evidence so that it is constitutional. Given that, the trial judge's decision on a motion to strike here was appropriate, because there was plenty of evidence before him at that point in time of proper constitutional behavior by the Board of Supervisors of Isle of Wight County. Among that was the fact that there was, in fact, a large refund that was given to all taxpayers when the Commission of the Revenue, who's an independent constitutional officer, decided to correct all of the M&T tax assessments, and which then triggered automatic, required by law, refunds of $5.6 million that were administered by the treasurer, another constitutional officer. At that point in time, the governing body was facing what had been and was an unbudgeted loss of $5.6 million and a need to address it. Their financial advisors said you need to address this because it will be bad if people see half of your general fund evaporate overnight. They also were concerned about what happens with that $5.6 million in case it is needed. There was also a policy that they should not get to 10% of their budget. And at that point, they were at risk anyway of approaching that. And so for all of those reasons, they certainly had a public purpose to set the tax rate for M&T tax year 2017 at $4.24. And to go back to Justice Goodwin's question about $1.75, I agree with Mr. Bell. $1.75 was the tax rate for 2016 and not for 2017. So if we go back to anything under Perkins or some other standard, it would have to be the 424 rate that was uniformly applied in the May ordinance that was adopted by the governing body of Isle of Wight of $4.24. It was adopted in May. Other evidence that supports the constitutionality of their acts goes to the grant. The grant is not a tax. The grant was a grant. It was a grant because the board said it was a grant. The board also set it up as a grant and appropriated money and budgeted money in two separate acts in June and July of 2017 to set aside and expend that money. It was expended through a budget amendment in June, which provided that $1.2 million was not available to be spent on police or schools or some other purpose or even just kept in the general fund. In fact, it was expended and not available for others, which is certainly authorized under Virginia Code Section 15.2-940.
Mr. McRoberts, this is Justice McCullough here. In your brief, you try to separate the two. There's a separate grant program distinct from the tax. But on this record, doesn't that sort of beggar belief that these things are separated? I mean, how can we sort of close our eyes to the fact that all of this was one thing and that, yes, you can have a grant program if you'd like to, but in this instance, aren't they together? And so, therefore, that would affect the analysis. Doesn't the record show that?
The record does not show that. The record does show that the Commissioner of Revenue developed a proposed $4.24 tax rate and at the same time was addressing the obvious concern of what happens in a frugal, tax-friendly county when you try to jack the tax rate from $1.75 to $4.24. The fear was basically taxpayer rebellion and taxpayers fleeing the county. There were two independent things. One was the need to address the $5.6 million gap. And then the other was, what do you do about the inevitable secondary result of what happens when you do that? They needed to address the gap, but they also needed to address the secondary concern of what happens when you do address the gap. They're related only in that one caused the concern about the other, but they were two independent acts.
This is Justice Goodwin. Wasn't the grant completely funded by M&T tax assessments?
No, sir. There certainly was money available to fund it in the general fund because of that. But if you look at the budget amendment, it was an overall budget amendment. And like all budget expenditures at the local government level, they come out of the general fund and all revenues go into it. They certainly did increase the tax rate in order to fill that hole. But as International Paper's own expert testified, dollars are fungible. Once you tax the people for money and then there is revenue in the general fund, and then once you budget it and spend it, it's not like you're taking the same dollar out that came in from a particular source and going out. In this case, it was two separate acts. One was an ordinance in May, and then the other was a grant program that was set up through two resolutions successively in June and July of 2017.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may go back to the earlier remark you made that this grant's not a tax, and a grant is a grant if the board decides it's a grant. Is that really true? Can the board simply call a tax discount a grant, and that ends the judicial review entirely just because they said so?
I didn't really say it ended the judicial review. What we're doing here is looking for the constitutionality in the evidence. And if there is evidence of constitutionality, then it is required for the courts to find it constitutional under the separation of powers and the standard of constitutional presumption of correctness. And so
how do you respond to the thought that it's not a grant at all? It's just a tax discount. That's really all it is. It's not a grant. What's the best comeback you have to that?
Well, the best comeback is the presumption of constitutional correctness. And
no,
that
don't,
is
don't give me a legal
way...
principle. Give me a factual point. How is this grant that the board enacted anything other than a tax discount?
This is not a tax discount because, one, it was declared to be a grant. Two, the board had authority to create the grant, and then they did it and said that that's what they were doing. It's not that much different, honestly, than the Elizabeth River Tunnels case, in which this court held that something that looked a lot like a tax was, in fact, a fee, in part because they had the authority to create one, and in fact, they did. And then when doing the constitutional analysis that the court did in that case, they weighed the evidence and said, in that case, the evidence shows that there were, in fact, constitutional purposes that supported it. And that same analysis would apply here to uphold the creation and implementation of the grant.
Counsel, this is Justice Powell. If you've finished Justice Kelsey's question, I have a question going back to your position that the tax rate for 2017 would revert back to the 424. If we find that we cannot sever the grant from the tax rate and find both to be unconstitutional, and if, as you and the appellant's counsel argue, the 2016 tax does not carry forward, then does that mean the county is left without taxes for this classification for 2017?
That's the end result. Thank you for that question. We can't end up there, Your Honor. And the reason you can't end up there is that would be a blatant violation of Article 10, Section 1 and Section 6, because the first says that all property shall be taxed, and it would leave their property untaxed for 2017. And then under Section 6, it says no exemption will be provided except under express authority. And in this case, they're asking for an exemption without any authority. And so
what would be the practical? What would be the practical result if we do find that the trial court improperly struck their case? They're asking that we find on the record that it was unconstitutional in final judgment. If we did that, what would be the practical result of that?
The practical result would be a violation of the Constitution, as I said. I mean, the practical result would be International Paper, unlike every other M&T taxpayer, would be untaxed for the year, which would be unconstitutional and frankly unfair to all the other taxpayers as well as to Isle of Wight.
If let me ask you a question. This is Justice Goodwin. If we declare the tax to be in violation of the Constitution, why would the other taxpayers still owe it? Why wouldn't you owe them refunds as well?
Well, I mean, if they decided to sue, yes, they would, ultimately. I mean, in this case, where I think both parties are in agreement that under Section 3984, it's the aggrieved taxpayer that seeks the remedy and is the one that has provided it. In this case, if the grant, for example, were found to be done in a non-uniform manner because it was a tax, which, of course, we say it's not, then severing the tax from the grant from the tax would be the only real logical remedy, because at that point in time, you've returned all the taxpayers to a 424 rate, and then every other taxpayer that it feels like they're aggrieved by this, then under that hypothetical unlawful grant, could sue and give their grant back also. We don't expect that would happen. To address the issue a little bit further between the sort of combination of the grant and the tax. I think one of the sort of sky is falling arguments that International Paper raised along that same line was a concern that, well, you know, this will be the way that every local government goes about it in the future if they can get away with this. This is a very unusual circumstance where a commission of revenue has corrected every single taxpayers' assessment all at one time and resulted in a refund that for a community the size of Isle of Wight is enormous. 5.6 was half of their general fund. And they couldn't reasonably not address it. Certainly that was an option. And as Judge Eason said, one option available to them was to simply not address it and suffer the repercussions if, in fact, their bond rating crashed, or if they couldn't get a loan the next year for something that was important, or if some other cost came upon them and they couldn't pay it, which has happened in some of our local governments in recent years. The fact is, Isle of Wight acted in a way that made sense. That was the position of fiscal responsibility. It was one that was advised by their financial advisors. And in fact, it did, fill the hole in the general fund, or what Judge Eason called a shortfall. I mean, the question then, I guess, pivots to what about this grant program? The grant program was created because when you jack a tax rate from $1.75 to $4.24 in a fiscally conservative, low tax in a county like Isle of Wight, it's likely to cause taxpayer revolt. And the industrial tax base is a very significant part of that tax base, as recognized by the fact that this adjustment was $5.6 million, half of their general fund. They felt like they needed to do something about it.
It seems as though, counsel, if I may interrupt you, it seems as though the adjustment had a target, and the target was IP.
Well, the evidence is contrary to that. There is no evidence to support the fact that that there was some intent to target IP. The evidence from the Commissioner of Revenue on the stand, for example, was that he was trying to estimate the amount of the grant methodology that would actually end up with a tax rate that would end up with the right amount of money to fill the hole in the general fund, $5.6 million. And the right amount of money to then fund this proposed grant program.
Well, did the 2017 ordinance, the $4.74 and the grant program, did it not simply recover the almost precise amount that had been lost from IP?
It affected all of the taxpayers uniformly across the board.
Well, if you wipe out the grants, it did, but the grants made it non-uniform, did it not?
No, it didn't make it non-uniform because a grant doesn't have uniformity applied to it. Article 10, Section 2 only applies to taxation, not grants. But then even if this court were to say, well, okay, we're going to treat the grant as a tax, taxes have to be uniform in methodology, not in amount. And in fact, the scattershot plot only shows alleged non-uniformity of amount, and they try to back into this tax rate that doesn't really exist. Their effective tax rate, as they call it, doesn't exist in a statute. It doesn't exist in any document that the Board of Supervisors created. It, in fact, doesn't exist at all. They created effective tax rate as defined by them and not by this court or by a statute in order to show, see, what we've created in fact is non-uniform. I mean, that's not the way that the presumption of constitutionality is supposed to work. The idea is the court is supposed to look for look at the evidence and determine if there is a constitutional way to read the evidence in a way that can result in a constitutional result. And if there is a way to do that, which Judge Eason found that based on that evidence, that was the only conclusion he could come to, then it has to be held to be constitutional. I mean, it's not appropriate to go look at evidence and say, look, there is some evidence of unconstitutional behavior, so therefore we need to find it unconstitutional. I mean, it's the contrary, is that if there is some way to read the behavior of the legislature to show that it is constitutional, then it needs to be held to be constitutional. And that's the
counsel. This is Justice Goodwin. Don't we have to look at the effect of the constitutional of the legislation to determine its constitutionality?
And in this case, Your Honor, if that's the analysis the court wishes to adopt, that's fine with us. The effect of adopting a 424 rate was the $5.6 million hole in the general fund was, in fact, filled. The effect of the grant
But the effect of putting the credits in place was to make sure that the only people who paid the tax increase were people who had gotten refunds.
Everyone paid the tax.
No, we're talking about the tax increase, not the tax. Look at your formula. Your formula gave them a grant in the exact amount of the difference between what their taxes would be without the increase.
No, that's
that was
not
the whole
actually
point
correct.
Of the grant, is to make sure people didn't have to pay the increase unless they had gotten a tax refund, wasn't it?
Well, it's not. That's not the way it really worked. I mean, the idea was that if the thing that is different in there, Justice Goodwin, is every M&T taxpayer, in fact, had a different amount of M&T for 2017 than they did for 2016, and different from 2015. And so that differed for 2017 from 2016. If you want to look at it IP's way, then, you know, perhaps the math works that way, but it also works in a way that shows that the board filled the $5.6 million hole and also provided this grant program to take care of taxpayers. And so given the fact that a grant is discretionary amount of money, it could be from zero up to however much the board wished to set aside for that. In this case, they set a grant program so that they raised taxes just enough, but not too much. I mean, one of the things International Paper complained of is that, well, they should have raised it 425 or 426 or 449 or something like that. Well, I mean, there's no reason for the governing body to adopt a tax rate one penny more than needed to take care of their two independent concerns. One is you've got to fill the hole.
This is Justice Kelsey, if I may interrupt you again. Suppose just hypothetically, 2017 ordinance is written 100% the way it was written, except for one thing. The word grant was not there. Instead, there was two words, tax discount. Would that ordinance, with no other change but the transposition of those words, would that ordinance be a uniform tax ordinance in compliance with Article 10?
Well, if it was a tax credit, then it would be unauthorized. And so you wouldn't even need to get to the constitutional question. Because the government.
Well, I'm asking the constitutional question.
But we wouldn't get to the tax because it would be unauthorized. I mean, what the board did is create a grant program under 15.2-940 and extended the money through a budget amendment and a appropriation.
I hear you. My question is different. My question is, if your ordinance was 100% word for word the same as it is, with one exception, the word grant has a different expression there. It's tax discount. Would that ordinance satisfy Article 10 of the Virginia Constitution?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't know exactly what a tax discount is and how it would apply in that circumstance.
Tax discount is you don't have to pay as much tax as you ordinarily have to pay. How about that?
If there was a different tax rate applied to International Paper than anyone else, which didn't happen in this kind of a case, then that might be unconstitutional. But I don't know how that would apply under this set of facts.
Counsel, this is Justice Powell.
All right, Justice Powell, go ahead.
Thank you. International Paper says that we can decide this case here. We have enough evidence in the posture of the case to decide it here. What is your position based on the posture in which the case arrives to us?
No, ma'am, it cannot be, and that's really for a couple of reasons. One is it was decided on a motion to strike, and so the county did not actually get a chance to put on its case. Second of all, International Paper has argued that everything needs to be looked in the light most favorable to it, and because it is a motion to strike stage, If they want to now say that we're going to accept the trial judge's decision as a final judgment, it should be entitled to the weight that jury verdicts were given. And that would mean that all the judge's findings in the case would have to be accepted as a jury verdict. And in this case, I mean, the judge made a number of findings, including that that it was public purposes, that there were two separate acts, that et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's no way they could prevail under presumption of constitutionality given those findings. But if this court is determined to find some illegality here, then a remand would be the only possible remedy. But our position is that given the fact that nothing here being challenged is an actual assessment under either of the two meanings of the word as decided in the Augusta County versus Hoffman case, because they don't complain about the tax rate, although they complain the fact that it was adopted and they complain about how it affects them. They don't complain really about the annual tax as shown on the tax bill. They complain about the result of the balance due or the amount due after the subtraction of the grant. And that simply is not a tax. It doesn't have to be uniform. It's the same as what happens when Isle of Wight County adds its stormwater fees, which this court has held are not taxes. They add their stormwater fees to the face of the real estate tax bills. And then there is an amount due at the end that adds the amount due from the stormwater fees to the real estate taxes. That doesn't create a unconstitutional effective tax rate problem either. I think that's the real problem. I mean, they're arguing that something that is not a tax is in fact a tax. And then by taking the amount due, which the tax bill and certainly the Board of Supervisors never called a tax, by doing that, somehow it creates this non-uniformity problem. When the Board of Supervisors and no document that's adopted by the Board.
Justice Powell, has he answered your question?
Yes, Chief. Thank you. Yes.
All right, thank you. Your time has expired.
All right, thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Bell, you have 5 minutes and 29 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I want to first go back to the concept of what is a grant based on the question. And also, I think Justice Kelsey asked the question about if you change the terminology, does that pose a problem that makes something unconstitutional? And first of all, when we look at what is a grant in a traditional sense, it is something that involves an agreement between a taxpayer and an agency that a taxpayer is to do certain acts. Maybe it's going to invest capital, create jobs, something that it does on a positive way that's a benefit to the county. In exchange for that, they receive benefits, whether it's reduced taxes, whether it is a grant of funds. That's when you think of a grant, that is what you think of. I would ask the court, I want to point out, in the trial, the county testified through a corporate representative, which was their county attorney. And when asked about what this economic development or retention grant is, the response was, we can call it whatever we want. That's at the joint appendix of page 1244 to 1245. When Mr. Gwaltney, the Commissioner of Revenue, testified as to it, he said it's a tax credit or it's a subtraction from the amount of tax due. So you can tell that while the documents want to call it a grant, those that are enforcing the law really are ignoring that and saying it's whatever we want it to do, and that was to claw back the amount of the refund. Now, the question as to whether a grant is subject to uniformity is the wrong way to look at it, with the county's argument. You have to look at the class of people within the property class. And what you're looking at is the tax burden. This court has said on a number of occasions that you are not to have an unequal tax burden on similarly situated taxpayers. A good example of this, I'm going to take you back to that plot, scatter plot, is there are three individual dots highlighted on that chart. Each one of those dots represents a taxpayer who filed approximately $50,000 of M&T, and the tax rate imposed varied for each one, and the amount of taxes that each one paid varied from about $600 and some to about $2,000. So the credit or the grant or the deduction or the possible exemption or whatever the county chooses to call it had the effect to cause an unequal burden, and that violates the uniformity provision. Remember, this is an as-applied challenge, and therefore the county might think it has all sorts of good reasons to fill a hole caused by their prior unconstitutional extraction of taxes from these taxpayers, but you're supposed to look at this at IP's, what this did to IP, and the county had lots of options of ways to handle it. The characterization of the evidence that they were about to violate the whole or their policy, there's no evidence in a record to that effect. They have a policy that says that they keep 10% of their general funds anticipated for the year as a line that they try to stay above. There's no evidence in a record to suggest they even got close to that after the impact of the refunds, and there was expert testimony to that effect. Now, the county tried to challenge that, but yet in their brief on page 13 at the footnote, when they said, well, yeah, we did find another $3 million of revenues that we didn't have. So again,
Mr. Bell, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt again, you lost this on a motion to strike, right? The county hadn't put on its evidence in chief. Does that mean that your best case scenario on appeal is a remand for the court to complete the evidentiary record and to take whatever guidance this court gives into account?
I would say no. If this court sets aside the clawback rate and the ordinance is unconstitutional, then that means the levy is unconstitutional and there's nothing the county can do to fix it. Again, if this court finds that, as applied, IP's constitutional rights were violated, then no matter what good reasons they may think they have, will not cure that taint. The assessment must be set aside, and then the county has to go back and figure out, what do we do now? What rate should we use? What other taxes should we do? What other options do we have to fill some sort of perceived hole? Which, by the way, they only allocated $32,125 to basically deal with the $5,600,000 of refunds it generated. I believe my time is about to end. I would just simply request that the court...
Excuse me, counsel. I've got a question for you. This is Justice Goodwin.
Yes, sir.
How can we make the ruling that you are asking us to make about the unconstitutionality of this particular statute and the grant ordinance as well without having all the evidence heard by the circuit court?
Well, the county...
Doesn't the county get an opportunity to present their evidence as to why that's not the case?
This court finds that an as-applied constitutional challenge exists. Then there's really nothing the county can put on that would dispute it. At page 45 and 46 of their brief, the county concedes there are no disputes of material facts. In other words, there is no facts. In fact, in their brief, they even recommend this court enters a final judgment. Now, today, we're hearing something different. And we're in agreement with their statement in their brief and that you have all the facts. They said there's no other facts. Everything was transparent according to them. All the government records are in the record. There is everything there. And therefore, an as-applied constitutional challenge exists, as best exemplified by the scatter plot. There is no valid reason the county can have to be able to offset a finding that their assessment is unconstitutional, and that should be
counsel,
the end of the inquiry.
Counsel, this is Justice Powell. As I'm reading your assignments of error, they all seem to ask us to decide to answer the question as to whether the trial court erred because you made a prima facie case. So if those are your assignments of error, how do we get from deciding whether you made a prima facie case to deciding that you win the case?
Because the county on brief conceded that there are no material facts, that all relevant evidence is in the record on pages 45 to 46, and we agree with that. and therefore you have everything in your hands to render a final judgment.
Did he answer your question, Justice Powell?
Yeah, thank you, Chief.
All right. Call the next case.